You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, August 7th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, with 20 questions for President Obama's live chat on mortgages, David Dayen. Also telling us about the implications of a world without a Fannie and Freddie as we know it. Also on the program today, Department of Justice looking into the abuse, or I should say claiming to look into the abuse of NSA surveillance by domestic police agencies. Yes, folks, that was the problem. Give a man an inch, he thinks he's a ruler, so to speak. Meanwhile, Occupy and libertarians force a police chief in New Hampshire to order, well, not quite a tank, but pretty close. And we will get to that story of the children living under a gag order by a fracking company. Also, Cory Booker, not just a mayor from New Jersey, but also a wildly successful tech entrepreneur. And we've got audio of a great exchange between a 14-year-old activist and a right-wing Canadian entrepreneur TV show host over the issue of GMO labeling. All that and more. Quickly, President Obama apparently has canceled a one-on-one summit with Vladimir Putin. Apparently, he's afraid to look into his eyes and see him mano a mano. It's unclear what the specific reasons are. One of them, obviously, is the Obama administration is upset that even though they welcome the debate that could only happen because of Edward Snowden's leaks, they're upset that they're not able to prosecute him and that he's been granted asylum. They also are reportedly upset at the Russian human rights violations of gay people. So President Obama has canceled a one-on-one meeting with Putin. He will be attending the G20 economics summit in St. Petersburg. But take that for what it's worth. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to get David Dayen on the phone to talk about mortgages. We'll be right back after this.
Hit me like a tongue.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's always a pleasure to welcome back to the program David Dayan, now I believe staff writer for Salon.com. Is that right?
I believe they're calling it contributing writer, so well, I have a once-a-week column there. So
all right, fair enough.
Not on staff, really, but I will be contributing weekly.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, you're now the editor of Salon. Congratulations.
I plan to buy Salon very soon because that's the trend now.
Yes.
I want to keep up with the Joneses here on the West Coast.
You left coast moguls, always looking for a...
Looking for
a hobby
media
horse.
Product, a viable media product to purchase.
All right. So, speaking of viable products, President Obama yesterday was in Phoenix and introduced. That's happening today. But he was in Phoenix yesterday, talking about the administration's second term housing agenda, He will be today doing a follow-up, a live chat at 1 p.m. moderated by the CEO of Zillow, where you can go on and see what your house is worth or what a house is worth by some algorithm, which I don't quite follow. But be that as it may, before we get into the 20 questions that you would like President Obama to be asked today, tell us what he's outlined in terms of replacing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And before you even do that, tell people what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are and what they do.
Right. So there are two mortgage markets, basically. There's the primary mortgage market, and that's where a homeowner goes in or a prospective homeowner goes in, wants to buy a house, gets a mortgage from a lender, and agrees to pay a monthly payment, and if they default on that payment, the house gets repossessed. That's the primary mortgage market. There's a secondary mortgage market where the lenders then sell those loans, and in recent years, it's almost entirely sell those loans to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who then repackage all those loans into securities, into bonds, that they then sell on the open market.
And that's sort of a tertiary market, if you will, right? I mean, the securitization of these loans is sort of the third market.
Yeah, I mean, there's the securitization market. Yeah, I mean, if you want to call it three markets. The secondary market generally refers to this securitization market, that these loans are purchased, packaged, and sold back out into the market. And the reason for this is to create the capital, because that money that is paid for these bonds is then plowed back into the selling of more loans. So the idea, in theory, is that we need this secondary market because banks won't just hold your loan for 30 years. There's interest rate risk there that they're selling it at a 4% interest rate. Interest rates go up, and they're losing money. Essentially, they're losing opportunity costs, but that in their theory, that's losing money. And so we wouldn't have the large home ownership rates we have in this theory if we didn't have this secondary market that created a lot of liquidity, a lot of capital that could be used to sell more loans.
Now,
so that's the idea.
Now, we should say that prior to the housing crisis, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bought up about 40% of the loans. It's now up close to about 85%, is my understanding.
Used to be a private securitization market that mainly dealt in the subprime sector and would package these loans and send them out, but it was the most hopelessly corrupt market in 80 years. I mean, it's lied about the quality of the loans in the pool. Sometimes it put the same loan into two or three different pools. It would, through the servicing sector, it would do things that were not in the best interest of the investor, because the investor would get the security, then they would hire this company, a servicer, to service the loan, take the monthly payment, and distribute it to the investors. Well, the servicer was ripping off the investor as well, by foreclosing when a modification would have been more profitable for the investor, by just lying and saying they were still servicing certain loans when they weren't anymore, the ones that were sold off, hiding the losses on loans and still collecting the servicing fees. So there are about 20 different ways that investors in private label securities were being ripped off. And that's why they just pulled out of the private label markets and they rode to the safety of Fannie and Freddie, where they would get a government guarantee, basically an implicit guarantee that they would not lose money on this buying these mortgage-backed securities from Fannie and Freddie.
And so now we should say that this was one of the big roots of the financial crisis.
The big root. I mean, the number one reason why we had a financial crisis was the explosion in private label mortgage-backed securities, and that built up a very unsustainable housing bubble. And when it crashed, these securities and derivatives based off the securities, collateralized debt obligations and things like that, just accelerated the financial crisis by magnifying the impact of the collapse of the housing bubble.
Now, and just to touch on one of the right's favorite zombie lies, Fannie and Freddie, we said, had only about 40% of that market, and they entered that market after the private label securitization had already sort of taken off in the early 2000s.
Particularly in the case of subprime, they entered very, very late in the game, tried to catch up, you know, in a market share capacity. But they did not cause the crisis, nor did the Community Reinvestment Act cause the crisis. You only have to look to the fact that other countries had housing bubbles and didn't have Fannie and Freddie involved,
right,
but did have a private label securitization machine to know that this was the proximate cause of the crisis.
Now, ostensibly, the fact that Fannie and Freddie hold 87% of those loans on the secondary market also is indicative of the fact that those loans are of a better quality because apparently they have tighter controls. Is that also what we're
understand? In the wake of the crisis, there were tighter lending standards put into place. Fannie and Freddie have the ability to say that they're not going to buy certain loans. And so that you know, creates a sort of a cascade through the system, and originators have been a little more circumspect in terms of giving out loans. But, of course, everybody in Washington says, oh, my God, Fannie and Freddie own 80%, 7% of the market. We got to get rid of them. We have to get rid of them. We have to put private capital back in the center of mortgage finance. And that was the point of Obama's speech yesterday. And my question is, why would private finance want to be back in the center when they were abused horrifically when they were in the center of mortgage finance in 2006 and 2007?
Okay, now let me ask you this. What is the problem with Fannie and Freddie holding 85% of those loans?
There is a somewhat legitimate problem, potentially, in that if Fannie and Freddie lower their lending standards, if there's a recession, if there's a crisis, if they take losses on the loans, then the government guarantee kicks in and taxpayer money is at risk.
Okay.
I mean, so there is an issue there with Fannie and Freddie owning or guaranteeing basically the entire mortgage market. The way around that, in my view, is to create situations where lenders retain more of the risk of loans, number one. And number two, create options so that people aren't psychologically led into believing that they have to own a home in order to be a real American, and create opportunities for rental, which is much more stable, or at least can be, and you can actually create stability and community aspects if you would do it in a proper way. So there are ways around that. The exact way not to deal with the risk, the potential risk of taxpayer money in Fannie and Freddie, is to recreate the private securitization machine and expect it to work better somehow the next time around.
Right. Well, that's the point. I mean, we all of the bailouts that we were liable for, or that our government extended, were a function of where it seems we want to return to, according to what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I mean, in a large sense. Now, first of all, I just don't believe that investors have any interest in going back into private label mortgage-backed securities. I just don't see why they would. If you were told, remember that company that totally ripped you off? They want your money again. And by the way, this time there's no government guarantee for it, so you're liable for the losses and forget about it. Why would they want to go back into such a market? So that's my biggest problem is I don't think that any of this would work. The only way it would work is if you give enough of a subsidy to the buy side in order to induce them to buy mortgage-backed securities. And at that point, you have just Fannie and Freddie with names that are not called Fannie and Freddie. You're continuing to advance a subsidy for mortgage-backed securities. You're just not doing it under the auspices of this government-sponsored enterprise. You're doing it under the auspices of something else, whether it's subsidizing private mortgage insurance that these buyers of mortgage-backed securities could buy, or subsidizing it in some other fashion. And the question really has to go back to the beginning. But is this the best use of taxpayer dollars to do this kind of subsidy? Is it a good use of taxpayer dollars to include this massive mortgage interest deduction that is it costs, I think, $1 trillion a year, and that subsidizes home ownership? Do we really need home ownership at the levels that we have it right now so that we have to massively subsidize people so they can create a market to encourage home ownership?
What has traditionally been, I mean, I understand it's the American dream, right? We got the white picket fence, we get the dog, we get the two kids.
In many ways, what you just described is the problem. Like the idea that this has been beat into the heads of Americans collectively, that they're not a real, true American if they live in an apartment in a city, or if they live in they don't live the dream that you just described, that they're somehow inadequate. I mean, this is the problem, and it creates these massive distortions and subsidies, which ultimately go to elites, banking interests, and the upper middle class, and it transfers wealth upwards.
We should also say that a part of this, you know, that it's the white picket fence thing, but it's also the notion of, you know, having been in my early 40s, late 30s, watching the sort of the valuation of real estate skyrocket, there's still this sort of residual feeling of like, I'm going to miss the boat. This is the best investment out there. And that even though we had a little hiccup for a couple of years, the boat is leaving. I mean, I'll tell you something. In New York City, anyways, right now, rents are going through the roof, and apartment sales of apartments have increased by, I don't know, like 15-20% over the past year or something in terms of valuations. And now New York is, I think, fundamentally different than the rest of the country, but there has to also still be that residual of like, if I don't buy a house now in 30 years, I'm going to have missed out on all this new money that it would have been accrued.
Right. So we're encouraging individuals to throw all of their savings into this highly, highly volatile asset that is no less volatile than something like a dot-com stock in many ways. I mean, if you look at the bubble and the crash, it's basically the same dynamic. Out here in Los Angeles, the largest year-over-year increase in housing prices during the housing bubble was about 25% year over year. Mm-hmm. In June of this year, the year over year increase was 28%. So, we're going back down that road again. And there has to be somebody that says, we don't need to recreate this market. We don't actually need to create the only savings vehicle for large numbers of Americans to be this risky asset that you have to subsidize in all these kind of discrete ways in order to continue to generate at great risk to the economy, as we just saw 5 years ago. So it's really a large ship you have to sort of turn around here to get to that point, but we have to get to that point.
And so by getting rid of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, at least in terms of being an entity that is backstopped by the government, guaranteed by the government, are we heading in that right direction? I mean, because theoretically,
well, I mean
this is question 19 that you want to ask President Obama. Why would private investors go back into that securities market? Which theoretically, the implications of that are, if they don't, then there's no capital for further loans, which would theoretically diminish the amount of loans given to buy houses, and then we would sort of de facto achieve that goal of discouraging home ownership, right? I mean, so why is that not a good thing?
I mean, potentially, but my suspicion is that there will just be large subsidies that will be granted to recreate this market. The thinking in Washington is we have to have this secondary market. We have to have a situation where we're creating large amounts of money that can be plowed into loans and increase the rates of home ownership. Incidentally, we've been talking about this housing recovery for the last year. The home ownership rate has actually dropped over the last year and a half, while prices have gone up and sales have gone up, although a lot of those sales are to investors that don't actually live in the home. So the situation is that I just don't have any faith that there's a fundamental rethink of this whole notion of home ownership. Although, to his credit, Obama did name-check affordable rental housing yesterday in his speech. I just don't have much faith that there's this fundamental rethink going on, more than we're going to get to this secondary market by any means necessary.
Okay.
So, yes, restructuring Fannie and Freddie so that there's not this kind of bubble mentality going on, I guess that's okay, but unless it's accompanied by these real changes where you get banks retaining more risk, where you get, instead of putting that risk out onto the market where it can't be priced well, where you get real options for rental affordability, it all goes in a piece with one another. You can't just say, let's get rid of Fannie and Freddie and, you know, hope that the worse the better, that shocks the system into
right.
Stopping the mortgage machine.
All right, we got 2 minutes left here because I know you got to go. You got to do a different show because, you know, you're a busy man. I understand these left coast media moguls. All right, so on one hand, let me just get the politics. On one hand, we have a lot of pressure to essentially divest the U.S. government of its liability through Fannie and Freddie Mac. Who is also pushing? And your fear is that if we do that without a comprehensive plan, we're going to end up subsidizing that secondary market by some other means that is going to have us have just as much liability, but it's going to allow for more irresponsibility in that market, and we're going to get right back.
By the way, you'd be transferring the risk, or transferring this guarantee, I should say, from Fannie and Freddie, or at least nominally government-sponsored enterprises, into the sell side of these securities, which are the banks, who are now profiting wildly, because Fannie and Freddie are profiting wildly now. That's what happens when you have a monopoly. The largest banks, who would probably monopolize the mortgage-backed securities market, armed with this guarantee, if they subsidize the product enough so that people would actually buy it, would then profit massively from essentially a taxpayer guarantee.
So that's the agenda.
Why do we want that?
That's the agenda that's really pushing on this, right? That's
absolutely
the countervailing force.
Absolutely.
All right.
I mean, the House Republican bill, which is even to the right of what Obama and the bipartisan Senate bill, which is Bob Corker and Mark Warner, have been putting together, has no role for the government whatsoever. And just sort of leaves this off to the devices of the market. And yet there is this, secondary attachment here that by virtue of insuring this market, you would create this guarantee that would get transferred to the largest banks in America, and they would create massive profits for themselves.
So it's basically the idea is let's blow the bubble up again, and then we'll cover the losses at that point without the without any means in which to make sure that these loans are not like they were 7 years ago.
It's very problematic, but I have to say I will make a pitch for people to read over at Salon my story with these 20 questions for Obama on housing, because only one of them deals with this issue of Fannie and Freddie, and most of them deal with the fact that, you know, we still have a foreclosure crisis in many parts of this country. We still have a situation where banks are foreclosing on people with false documents. We have a situation where they're ripping off homeowners through their servicing departments, that they're lying about whether or not they got records for a loan modification. They're pushing people into foreclosure. Virtually nothing has changed in terms of the abuses and the fraud that has gone on in this market for the last several years, despite the fact that we have all these settlements that were supposed to end the conduct. And so a great number of my questions, I get at this very point that they're and the fact that, you know, criminal behavior is usually deterred by prison time, and we've seen absolutely none of that, and why isn't there a push to open new cases if we're seeing the exact same conduct for which there were these large settlements that were put upon the banks? So I urge people to read that, and it's not just that, it's pretty comprehensive in terms of all aspects of the housing market and housing policy, but they're questions that need to be answered. I'm not sure they will be today, but they need to be.
Well, if you had more time, we would go through all those. That was my plan, but I only got stuck on 19. I know you got to run. David Dayan, thank you so much for your time today. We will link to those 20 questions, and people should ask them if you can get on that live chat. Pick a question of David's and ask.
In the next half hour. It's happening in the half hour. So if you flood the zone on Twitter with the Ask Obama Housing hashtag and start asking some of these questions, maybe we can create enough pressure.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, how many people are going to be using that hashtag anyways?
No idea.
All right.
So give it a shot.
David Dayan, thanks so much. I appreciate the time, buddy.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, we're going to link to his questions, and let me just go over them a little bit. I mean, he seemed to have forgotten that he's got an appointment in a minute 30 seconds to do the Ed show, I think, with Pap. And I'm going to get in trouble with Pap. He goes through the questions. I mean, I just briefly, one of them is about the failure of HAMP, the Home Affordable Modification Plan, the Homeowner Affordable Modification Plan, which essentially was just an abject failure. He talks a couple of questions about HAMP. He talks about the allegations from Bank of America whistleblowers that they are deliberately told by superiors to lie to homeowners and block loan modifications because they do better when they foreclose. There are more questions in terms of why do you keep making a differentiation? And this is a really important one. Let me read it. Why do you continually distinguish between what you call a responsible and irresponsible homeowner? Do you use the same language to single out irresponsible welfare or food stamp recipients or natural disaster victims? Isn't it the job of the lender to check a borrower's credit worthiness and subsequently how, quote unquote, responsible their decision is to take out the loan? This is something that is completely lost in the conversation about this. There is a fiduciary responsibility by a loan officer, not a loan clerk, not a loan checkout person, not a loan cashier, a loan officer, to validate whether or not someone is worthy of a loan. He goes on to say, haven't banks admitted to preying on communities with low incomes and poor financial literacy, steering them into risky, higher-cost loans? Why aren't you talking about irresponsible banks? Now, Dane's playing loose and fast with the concept of 20 questions, because he embeds like four questions per question. Nevertheless, that question number five really gets to the heart of the matter. Now, a lot of this stuff is stuff that we've been talking about now for 5 years. And in fact, a lot of the SEC enforcement, their attempts, or at least their going through the motions of enforcing a lot of this stuff, starting to dwindle now because we are just about at the statutory statute of limitations. But these are questions that have yet to be resolved, because we are now sort of moving back into a period where we start to see, you know, what Dane is talking about here is that to just get rid of Fannie and Freddie without a comprehensive plan, one that has a strategic vision on the way that our government should be treating home ownership, just essentially throws this to the wolves. And we're going to get right back to where we were in 2008. But this element of, you know, and this harkens back to, you know, Frank Santelli or whatever that guy's name is, sitting on the commodities market in Chicago, talking about, are we going to pay for these people's loans? And all these traders are like, no! This is the point. This is the job of loan officers at banks. It's why we have things like FDIC. It's why we have government bailouts of banks, right? It's presumably because these banks have a higher level of responsibility within the social fabric than someone who is selling you a car. A car dealer does not have an obligation unless they're giving you a loan to determine whether or not you can afford this. The obligation is not just to the investor who's going to buy the securitized version of that loan. It is also to society at large, so that we have a functioning banking system. And I would love a libertarian to describe to me, like, we should even have less bank regulation. Let these banks fail. And then just, you know, people can't get credit, they can't get credit. This is part of our society. You can live in this fantasy world where let the chips fall where they may. And then hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, losing their job, tens of millions of people could have lost their job with a complete total bank failure. So check out these questions. I hate to discourage anybody from listening to this program live, but you can tweet the live chat on Twitter. Follow it simultaneously, and during the better half of the program, call in and let us know what's going on that end. Now, I'm going to shift gears here. And I so much want to get to these clips of the 14-year-old anti-GMO activist, but maybe we're going to save that for the better half of the show, because I also – and I want to get to that gag order story, but I want to talk about this this NSA story from Reuters yesterday, because it is incredibly important, indicative of – there's been some great sort of tangential pieces on this, one by Jay Rosen. Maybe we'll have him on. But talking about the Tubin principle, wherein And you should listen to this, Michael. the idea that Snowden's a criminal, he should go to jail, but it's good that we're having this debate. Now, of course, this debate would not have happened. I call it the Tubin principle or the Michael Tubin principle. This notion.
That's the most insulting thing anybody's ever said to me. Conflating me with Tubin.
The idea, I mean, it is quite clear now. And I'm curious. Because, Michael, you did have an issue with him going to, that it somehow his, you know, seeking asylum in Russia, which is not a free society, granted, stipulated, somehow put a taint upon his revelations. Do you still feel that way now that we see the implications of his revelations in terms of just how much activity we are seeing from our lawmakers in terms of addressing this stuff and the subsequent reporting? Because the story from Reuters is very, very important.
I would also like to add that after watching Obama on The Tonight Show last night, Michael, you would find yourself in good company with Jay Leno, too.
Ugh. Jay Leno, who I would say, you know, Bill Hicks called the devil just for
now.
Just for so
I can't even watch this.
So let's just hear. Let's just hear.
Okay, no, let me answer the question.
Let's just hear from the Tubin Leno set.
All right.
Speaking on behalf of Tubin and Leno.
That's not what I said. So what I said was I said three things, and one was two were opinions and three was what I thought was objective. Just the oh, come on. Don't be a putz.
No, go ahead. Let's hear it. Let's hear it.
So number one, I said from the beginning 100% the revelations about the surveillance program are really important. I support them 100%, and it was smart for him to flee. And I said that before the conviction. Bradley Manning was tortured. I didn't need to know he would be convicted to know that there are obvious repercussions. And then
hold on 1 second. Let me just pause 1 second. I need to say one thing. I need to make a correction. Yesterday, I said that that Bradley Manning was going to be sentenced yesterday at 1 p.m. That was incorrect. I don't know how we got that wrong, but I want to apologize right now. Obviously, he hasn't been sentenced yet, and he will be forward. I meant to start the show that way. All right, continue.
So
one, you supported the revelations. Two,
I felt very differently about the hacking revelations and the implications of that. So then it went to a different thing where it was like, all right, this dude is in Hong Kong. Then he's in Russia. He's talking about a completely different set of revelations there, which have totally different stakes. I don't know what the motivation behind that is.
So two, you didn't support the hacking revelations.
I didn't necessarily support the second round. And then I think that going to places that are adversarial and don't have great records like Russia and China and then revealing things that don't have the same type of direct stakes are questionable. And then the third thing I said was I thought that the conversation when he went to Russia in America would shift to should he be in Russia. That wasn't my personal opinion. That was a prediction of what would happen in the conversation, which is exactly what did happen. But I don't.
But that's actually been now been overtaken, right?
The whole time, I don't begrudge him trying to save himself. I begrudge some of the revelations, but not his taking care of himself. And the NSA revelations, I'm 100% for. But so I don't know if that clears anything up.
But Snowden leaked this information to Glenn Greenwald and The Guardian and told them to use their journalistic integrity
and I could totally be wrong because I think like Stuxnet turned into a worm that did affect the global internet. So I'm just saying I'm less clear about that. Also, like Greenwald said that everything's encrypted and there's no way like Russian intelligence has looked at these files. I think that's ludicrous. It's hard
Snowden
to
still claims that, but I mean
I don't buy that. But again, it's not about personalizing it with him or denying, you know. He's trying to preserve himself.
At this
and
point,
he
do you think
really...
he should go to? Do you think he should go to jail?
I think that either.
Do you think he's a whistleblower?
I think he's a whistleblower, and I think. But even Greenwald said, if one of these guys went to jail for like 6 months for stealing a document or something, that's totally different than the charges they've been hit with, which obviously they should not be convicted of. And he is foremost the whistleblower.
I think the arguments that he's not a whistleblower have had to have been re-examined based upon the implications of the information that's out there.
That's what
and
Amash
here's
said.
The key that Jay Rosen, and now I'm off topic from that Reuters story, but this is really important stuff. The fact of the matter is that lawmakers either knew or deliberately kept themselves ignorant of what was going on and were unable, in some instances, to make an argument that this should be reexamined. And I'm talking specifically about the way that the Patriot Act and the FISA amendment, the FISA as amended in 2008, was reinterpreted by the FISA court and became more expansive. The definition of relevant became more expansive. Therefore, the NSA was allowed to collect and store and all of this content and data to be examined later if they so needed to. That debate could not happen when Congress was given the responsibility for oversight, but without any public knowledge of what they were supposedly overseeing. What we are seeing now is that when the public is aware of this, it puts pressures on Congress to actually do their due diligence and provide legitimate oversight. That is the dynamic that exists now. So you cannot say, I'm glad we're having this debate, but I think Snowden is not a whistleblower to go to jail, because we would not have had this debate at all. And not just I'm talking about in the media or on this program, but I'm talking about in the Senate or in the House. That debate would not exist were it not for Edward Snowden's leaks. Period. End of story. Is he a perfect individual? No. Is anyone a perfect individual? No. Did he leak stuff that one may or may not think he should have leaked? If only he had only leaked 87% of what he leaked as opposed to the other 13%. I think that is silliness. It's silliness. And it's disingenuous. Okay, because there should not be that much responsibility on any one individual to be that precise in this type of situation. I'm sorry. That's just the reality of it. But you really feel you need to respond to that?
You're implying I'm being disingenuous.
No.
Okay.
I just wanted to mention a few things from the Obama Tonight Show appearance, because Obama said he said specifically, we do not have a domestic spying program, which, I mean, clearly we don't, because the revelations show that we're just swept up in this foreign spying program. There's not a specific American spying program. But at the same time, too, like, we're supposed to just be okay with us, you know, spying and having this mass surveillance on even our allies just because they're not Americans. Like, we're supposed to be.
I mean, look, that to me is a. Is a different argument. And I mean, and I'm not saying it's not a valid one, but it's just not. I want to stay on this because I want to talk about this Reuters story, because the idea that we don't have a domestic spying program is as close to being a lie as you can get. Particularly if you're going to tell it on Leno. I mean, if you're going to go into a courtroom and you're going to have lawyers parse your words, then maybe you could argue, well, it really is depends on what your definition of a program is. But when you go on to Leno and say this, you are lying. Because the fact of the matter is, we collect massive amounts, all domestic communications. Or I should say, it is perfectly reasonable to believe that we cannot collect all domestic communications. We collect it, but it isn't necessarily spying in their definition until we access that material. But the problem is that this Reuters story makes it quite clear that, in fact, this information is accessed. It is not accessed exclusively for terrorism investigations. It is, in fact, accessed by, at the very least, for drug trafficking investigations, for drug investigations. Now, we were told on August 3rd by the New York Times that other agencies clamoring for data NSA compiles. That's the title of that story. The NSA's dominant role as the nation's spy warehouse has spurred frequent tensions and turf fights with other federal intelligence agencies that want to use its surveillance tools for their own investigations, officials say. Now, we should also say that Russell Tice, I think he was on Frontline, I think it was. I don't know who it was on. It was Judy Woodruff. Made the point that, look, you're building this huge data center in Utah. If you want to just collect everybody's metadata, you don't need that much storage. That data center is built for collecting the contents. Now, in the strictest definition of the word, we may not be spying on those contents. We're just warehousing them to be spied on later.
It's the library.
It's a library. Exactly. Go in, it's a lending library. Now, according to this piece in the New York Times, agencies working to curb drug trafficking, cyber attacks, money laundering, counterfeiting, and even copyright infringement complain that their attempts to exploit the securities agency's vast resources have often been turned down because their own investigations are not considered a high enough priority, current and former government officials say. Oh, well, that's very nice of the current and former government officials to say to us, because that gives us a reassurance. This information is firewalled. You're not getting it for drug trafficking or counterfeiting or even copyright information or protests, for that matter. Fusion centers can't get it. It's completely firewalled. Intelligence officials say they've been careful to limit the use of the securities agency's troves of data and eavesdropping spyware for fear they could be misused in ways that violate Americans' privacy rights. Phew. But then, four or five graphs down, smaller intelligence units within the Drug Enforcement Administration, Secret Service, the Pentagon, and the Department of Homeland Security. Department of Homeland Security, incidentally, basically means every police agency in the entire federal government and probably state governments through fusion centers and municipal governments, have sometimes been given access to the security agency's surveillance tools for particular cases, intelligence officials say. In other words, you know those first three paragraphs that we said, this never happens? Well, sometimes it happens. And then 2 days later, Reuters reports that a secretive U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration unit is funneling information from intelligence intercepts, wiretaps, informants, and a massive database of telephone records to authorities across the nation to help them launch criminal investigations of Americans. So in other words, this agency within the DEA gets information from the NSA and then sends it out to its two dozen partner agencies, including the FBI, CIA, NSA, Internal Revenue Service, and Department of Homeland Security. So, in other words, all of this information can be accessed by, at the very least, this one agency in the DEA, which works with the FBI, CIA, NSA, Internal Revenue Service, and Department of Homeland Security. Not only that, they are specifically instructed on how to create a parallel track of investigation so that when they use this information, they will never disclose it even to prosecutors. Never mind the defendants. You understand what's happening here. The NSA says to this agency within the DEA, hey, there's a truck in Tallahassee. You should, it's going to be at a truck stop on Route 95 or wherever it is. You should stop it. You should find the violation and you should stop it. So the DEA calls the Florida State Troopers, says, hey, there's a truck. It's going to be in Tallahassee at the truck stop on Route 95. You should see if it has a violation with a light out or something like that. That will give you probable cause. You smell something when you pull the guy over because he's acting funny. And boom, bang, bing, there you go. You've done your marijuana bust. Now, if this is happening with the Drug Enforcement Agency, and I can assure you, no one's going to get blown up by a truck full of marijuana. There is no existential threat to America from that truck. Where else is this information going? Is it going to fusion centers when they talk about Occupy protests? Is it going, I mean, where else is it going? And if it's not going there yet, do you really think in 5 or 10 years it won't be? This is the problem with that. And now we see the Department of Justice has launched an investigation into revelations that the Drug Enforcement Agency uses surveillance tactics, including wiretapping and massive databases of telephone records, to arrest Americans amid growing concerns from lawyers and civil rights groups over its lack of transparency. So supposedly now the Department of Justice is looking into this because apparently it is there's a reason why the DEA is instructing its agents and law enforcement agents acting upon these DEA tips to create a parallel narrative as to how this arrest happened. And to create a parallel narrative, in other words, a set of lies, to feed prosecutors. It's because if the prosecutors... There's one case in this Reuters piece that's mentioned. If the prosecutors were aware of this, they'd say, you know what? I can't build a case on this because this is unconstitutional what you're doing. You're not authorized to have this information. Give a man an inch and he thinks he's a ruler, or really he takes another inch, I guess, is really what it's. All right, we're going to take a break and head into the better half of the program. In the better half, we will talk about the NSA or the leaking that took place in terms of how we know about these supposed embassy attacks. We will also talk about Michael Hayden's comments as to those people who support Edward Snowden. I would call this sort of NSA trolling, probably. And we will get to that audio of the 14-year-old anti-GMO activist and the story about the fracking gag. We just got too much stuff. And now I've just given you another 13 minutes of free... well, I guess it's all free. First 53 minutes. Folks, if you can become a member of the Majority Report, we need your support. We are running a deficit for the month because of this app. Now, I should say, we are rolling out the beta testing. We have now sent it to the first 15 people. We have, I think, about 70 beta testers who have already sent emails in. We can't accept any more beta testers. We will get to most of those people based upon the order in which they emailed us. You will get it. Don't email us and say, I haven't gotten the beta test. You will get it when we can absorb your feedback. Android will probably happen next week or sometime, maybe in a week and a half. iPad will follow as well. But we really need your support to continue to grow the program and to continue to maintain it. It's very easy to become a member. You can join at majority.fm. It is pocket change a day to support the program. And I hope you will. You can, of course, support the program by buying your Amazon junk. If you buy Amazon junk, go to the homepage of majority.fm. Click on the Amazon link. Bookmark it. Buy your stuff from there always. You will notice no difference, but we will get a kickback. And also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coupon code majority, get 10% off. We'll be back in just a moment. You can call the program at 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be back in just a moment.